What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Well, look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar.
You think that tennis is about expressing yourself, doing your thing. But you don't know what tennis is.
What is it?
That's from Challengers, a movie set in the world of pro tennis, but audiences don't really come out of the movie talking about the tennis, do they, Josh?
I don't know. I mean, I got some good tips. This week on the show, we will have a review of the Luca Guadagnino-directed film, which stars Zendaya. We'll also have some thoughts on Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in The Fall Guy.
It's all ahead.
I'm going to give my review, Adam, while making a 250-foot jump across a ravine.
Can't wait. It's all ahead on Film Spotting. Welcome to Film Spotting, the number one movie at the box office last weekend. Josh, The Fall Guy. You saw it. Your wife, Debbie, saw it. I believe you were together.
Yeah, we decided to go together.
Sadly, did not make it to The Fall Guy. I'm blaming my oldest kid, Holden, who decided to graduate from college last weekend.
Not the Holden who I think within a year of first meeting him, he was like a little kid we took to some Comic-Con type convention to see Doctor Who. That same kid. It's ridiculous.
He's pretty much the same. He's just a little older. We've got Gosling, Blunt, stunts. I'm excited to hear what I missed. That's later in the show. First, though, the movie we probably should have gotten to last week, Challengers, Luca Guadagnino's tennis love triangle movie starring Zendaya, Mike Feist, and Josh O'Connor. Here's all three in conversation before things get steamy.
I should go. My dad comes looking for me. I'll see you at school, Art.
Wait. Are you on Facebook?
What?
He's asking for your number. And so am I.
You both want my number?
Very much so, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, well, I'm not a homewrecker.
We don't live together.
It's an open relationship.
Also, Patrick has a girlfriend.
I do not. Hey, come hang out with us later. They put you up at the hotel in Flushing, right? We're in room 206.
Want me to come tuck you in?
No. You can just keep talking. About tennis.
Good night.
We have beer.
Okay.
Josh, you walked into Challengers already being familiar with Josh O'Connor, who plays the brash, broke tennis pro Patrick, because you knew him from The Crown. In your non-movie watching time, good husband that you are, you and your wife have found various TV series to enjoy together. During my off hours, I'm probably watching a mostly mindless sports docuseries on Netflix. Like many others, I got into Formula One during COVID thanks to Drive to Survive. In fact, there were so many others who suddenly gravitated to F1. The show is on its sixth season, and the sport has never been more popular in the U.S., which is to say, it's actually kind of popular in the U.S. You might have even caught part of the Miami Grand Prix broadcast on ABC last weekend. The impact was so dramatic that it was dubbed the Drive to Survive effect, and naturally, every other sport hoping to rise in popularity sought to emulate it. Last year, Full Swing, a behind-the-scenes look at the PGA Tour, and Breakpoint, a behind-the-scenes look at world tennis, debuted. The series are constructed as competently as Drive to Survive, the same teams produce them, but you won't find any articles touting the Full Swing effect or Breakpoint effect. Neither the popularity of golf nor tennis has measurably increased since the release of these shows, despite their efforts to humanize the athletes with unprecedented access to their lives and the sport they've devoted themselves to. Why not? Well, the excitement of the sports themselves is arguably a factor. I'm going to make a bold statement and say that race cars battling for position at 200 miles per hour, the specter of a crash making every moment a matter of life or death, it's inherently more thrilling than sinking a 15-foot birdie putt or a backhand down the line resulting in a tiebreak. But it's not only the sport. It's also the storytelling. Because a 15-foot birdie putt or a backhand down the line resulting in a tiebreak can be more thrilling than a race, if I understand the stakes. Who are the heroes? Who are the villains? What's on the line? To quote Gene Jones, gas station proprietor in No Country for Old Men, I need to know what's being put up. What do I stand to win? The answer may not be everything, as Anton Chigurh says, but it should feel that way. I felt it with Drive to Survive, not so much with Full Swing or Breakpoint. So Josh, actually, I do want to talk a bit about the aesthetics of tennis as brought to life in Challengers. I know you didn't watch Breakpoint, but had Luca Guadagnino and his collaborators, DP Soyombu Mukdipram and editor Marco Costa, been responsible for the tennis scenes, might it have been more enthralling? But more importantly, what about those stakes? Did the human drama and the electricity of all those verbal volleys between Patrick, Art, and Tashi sufficiently invest you in all of those racket volleys?
One of the thrilling things, and there are many thrilling things about Challengers, is that those two elements are inseparable.
Mm-hmm.
And we will not talk about the result of the match that this entire film is structured around, but I think that is the epitome where you're waiting to see the final score, essentially, and yet it absolutely doesn't matter what the result is. And the filmmaking has known that all along, because the filmmaking in the tennis sequences has never been about, I mean, it's part of the equation. Who's getting this point? Where the ball lands? Who had serve? But what it is more about is the mental state of each player at that particular moment, and what the action, what the strategic choice they make means, sure, in this match, in this moment, but more importantly, what it means for them personally and the relationship dynamics at play for not only who's across the net, but who's watching in the stands. And that was what made Challengers really one of, I mean, we're talking top five sports movies, I think, at this point, because it isn't just about the sport. It has enough of that. It has enough sports stuff to engage, especially those who know their tennis. I like to think it's been a couple of years since since I played tennis for fun. But I remember enough to have been engaged on that level. But that wouldn't have mattered if this relationship, this three-way relationship that is at the core of the movie, was not so integral to what's happening on the court. That's the genius. That's the magic. That is what makes Challengers what it is.
Mm-hmm. I'm completely in sync with you here. The sport and the players themselves, that being inseparable, as you put it, really gets at the strength of this film. There is a bit of a sense of Luca throwing the kitchen sink at the tennis matches, and really the film as a whole, if you think about some of the bold choices he makes. But going back to the tennis specifically, we'll get the GoPro approach attached to someone's head, or maybe to the racket, or in one case, to the ball. Itself. But visually, it's engrossing because of that mental game that's being played, certainly, in those relationships, the human dynamic here. But it is also engrossing because of the physicality of it. And I think the way the camera expresses that physicality through movement, sometimes that's in slow motion, even that's the camera itself moving, but sometimes it's movement through cuts, which I really enjoyed here as well. And then the sound design, the emphasis on sound, the strenuousness of the effort, those heavy breaths, the bodies drenched. It's intense, but still graceful. And guess what? That's appropriate, because for all of its heat and copious amounts of kissing, there are no sex scenes.
Not really.
Except that sweaty, ecstatic tennis match. Yeah. It's as if Guadagnino said, that's going to be the challenge here to myself as a filmmaker. I'm going to make a steamy, sexy film where we get the initiation of perhaps some lovemaking, but I'm not actually going to depict any of it. It's only going to be what plays out on this court. That match that we come back to again and again, this whole film is nonlinear. That match is one long, broken up sex scene. And there may only be two players on the court, but as you noted, this is most definitely a threesome.
Yeah. And the sound design, I'm glad you called that out, because sound is crucial to tennis. If you've even just watched it on television, you can hear someone watching tennis in the next room, as is the case with many sports, televised sports, but tennis in particular, I think the thwack of the ball and, you know, the grunts or the yelps of the players. It is a very audible sport.
But it's not just audible. It's audio emanating from the people. If you think about these other sports, I know, right? I know F1's on, but I know F1's on because I can hear the cars going on the track.
Yeah, yeah.
I can hear the smack of a baseball or even the smack of a golf ball, but it's all coming from these human beings.
You mentioned the ball point of view shots, and I have to say, when he pulled that out of his back pocket, my immediate reaction was like, okay, we've gone a little far now. Uh-huh. But then I said, but all of the other choices that have been made, which are distinct, you're right, we get different shots throughout this film, have all related to, again, a psychological reality in that moment. And the ball point of view is so chaotic. This is towards the end where things have, this match and this three-way relationship has been thrown into chaos. So it makes absolute sense to, at that point, make the camera the most frenetic, jumping around all over the place, because those are the emotions that all three are being experienced. And then you have a trick like, I don't even know what you'd call it. It's like it's not a split screen. It's like a tri-split screen where you have each of the men on one side of the screen,
yeah,
and then Zendaya in the middle.
It's almost like a diopter shot,
yeah,
but not really.
Exactly. Yeah. It's just, you know, is it visually on the nose for what this movie is? Sure. But it also, being part of the match that's taking mm-hmm. place, captures what's going on in their heads. Yeah.
And he does save it.
He saves it.
He doesn't employ it throughout.
And he saves the ball point of view shots too. And we get other things where there are shots where the ball is coming right at the camera after a hit. You know, there's an immersiveness to that, putting us right on the court. It's different too. It's not like it's coming at us because we are in the shoes, at least this is how I experienced it, of Patrick or of Art. It's almost like it's coming at us because we're standing right behind the net where we shouldn't be, and we're going to pay the price for that. And it's a little bit, I like how it's maybe suggesting we shouldn't be this intimately involved in this relationship because yes. things are getting dangerous.
Well, that's the key word, Josh. I think it's the intimacy, and that also gets at the core strength of this film, because it's not just in those shots where you feel like the ball might be coming at you, but think about how often here Guadagnino employs point of view shots where the characters in some of their most intimate, vulnerable, and sexy scenes are looking right at the camera. They're looking right at us. Mm-hmm. It's like we are literally part of this scenario, and it's already overfilled with people in this love triangle, and then we're thrown into the mix as well. And that's where the sexiness comes from, but that's also this neat trick where, as a viewer, you're almost uncomfortable at times, but uncomfortable in a good way. It feels like you're engaged with the film, and like I said, it feels like you really are a part of this relationship. I think there is, you said it might be one of the best sports movies ever. I haven't played tennis in probably 10 years, Josh. And even then, I didn't play it regularly. So definitely not an expert. And if people want to write in and tell us that they got something wrong, I'll happily indulge you. But they look like tennis players to me physically. They move like tennis players to me. I don't care if it's CGI at times. I don't care if it's doubles at times. The combination of the longer shots that could be doubles and then working in all those close-ups and the different array of camera types and angles that he uses, it all felt completely authentic to me. And I think part of that authenticity also comes back to what we will often praise about the best musicals, right? Where he does give us those wider shots. Guadagnino knows when to show us the full court, when to show us those full bodies in motion, and then when to utilize tighter shots. I'll bring in another sport or leisure reference here, I guess. Guadagnino gets the good tennis is like poker. You play the person, not the cards. And I think that really underscores what works about this film. And it's reflected in the athleticism of the matches themselves, but it is about that human element that we talked about. I just love that I'll go back to that word engaging. I love the way with that motion and his observant camera style, even as frenetic as it is, I still think of it as observant, not in the way a filmmaker who maybe uses long static shots makes you focus on a frame, but he's really directing our eye a lot. And what it does is it forces you throughout to always be paying attention to what little clues he might be trying to give you. Clues into character, not clues and behavior and psychology, not clues into a plot. And I think, again, I'll mention the editing has a real elegance and fluidity to it here, not just the camera movement itself, but the camera is very intentional. The cuts are very intentional on and off the court. I really was always studying the frame as if every detail mattered. I think about a moment early on that could be a throwaway moment, but you also know it's there for a reason. When we have a flashback and we meet Art and Patrick as best friends, and they're about to play each other. It's at a juniors tournament. It's the moment where they meet Zendaya's Tashi for the first time. You notice they're talking all about, this whole scene is about Art basically saying, hey, we all know you're the better tennis player than me, but my grandma is going to watch and I want to win. Can you just let me win? And it seems like Patrick might even be game for that because he doesn't really care. That's one of his defining character traits. He just kind of goes with the flow. And they're walking up the stairs. And just at the last minute, as they actually walk into the row, Art dodges ahead of him. He kind of dances around him and gets to the seat first. And Art, the Feist character, he's more passive in all aspects. He's not as talented either. He is, as I said, basically begging Patrick to let him win. But when they get to their row, it's as if his psychology betrays him a little bit and he can't help, especially as now, you know, they're meeting Tashi and he's clearly head over heels in love with her, just as Patrick is. He feels the need to get ahead of him and beat him to the seat. So he can't help himself. He in that moment does reveal his real psyche. He wants to beat him, even if it means just beating him to his seat, even if beating him to his seat is the only way actually in that moment he can beat him.
Yeah, we have to get to each of these performances and spend a little more time with them. But quickly going back to the sports movie thing, I might have a little different, you know, I look for different things maybe. I'm not a huge fan of sports movies, probably one of my less favorite genres, but I don't demand authenticity when I go to them. Basically, what I want is a movie that is going to use the sport as a background that mm-hmm. feeds into the drama it is then going to explore. And it has to be believable enough for someone like me. And I think that Challengers definitely.
But even you, real quick,
that.
Josh, even if they had that, even if a basketball movie had that in spades, if it got a lot of the basketball wrong, as someone who regularly watches and loves basketball, I think you would find
that
chipping away.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. You wouldn't want them to fumble something obvious. Mm-hmm. And I agree with you. As far as I know, which is fairly limited, I don't think that Challengers does that. And then just to wrap up quickly on, you know, the filmmaking in the tennis matches. And this happens not just in the main match we keep returning to, but any match we see in the various flashbacks, I think. I'm sure we were going to get to it at some point. Might as well do it here because it connects to the editing, which you rightly praised. The editing is also in line with the Trent Reznor, Atticus Ross score. The emotions of the characters is driving a lot of the filmmaking in those tennis scenes. And then in concert with this is this clubby, blood-pumping score. And then that is related, I think, directly to the other thing you were talking about, which is the intimacy and the sensuality. Because it is music that is going to get, it's carnal, it's getting your blood flowing, right? It's music you'd hear in a club. The sensuality of this film is almost laughable how much it's at the forefront. I think of, you know, we get a sweaty close-up of both Art and Patrick, I think before we even get the MGM logo. It's immediately, it's like, we're not even going to wait for the logo. We're going to show you what this movie is interested in
and
right
like
away.
We're hearing them breathe and it's slow motion. I mean, there is sex from beginning to end with no sex.
And then every interaction with even the most, you know, minute characters, it's almost as if they're about to make out early on. Think about Art with his trainer, who's like leaning over him, stretching him out, and how close their faces are. And then
he bites his churro.
Well, that's a whole nother thing going on. Every interaction between the two of them, which
and
is
that's
a
not
variation.
A euphemism. It's literally a churro, everyone.
Yeah, exactly. And that's, you know, it's an extension of what you're talking about with racing him to the seat, right? Mm-hmm. It's this competitive, aggressive / erotic gesture. But I even think, Adam, another early one between Patrick, he's trying to talk his way into this hotel and his credit card is getting declined. And yeah. So as he's talking to the hotel clerk, this, you know, middle-aged woman, their faces are just getting closer and closer till their noses are almost touching. And it's not like he's really going to kiss her or she's going to kiss him. This is just how human beings interact in this movie. Every human being who comes near another human being is going to act this way. So it's amusing, but it's also emphasized by that score, which is just,
it's so good.
Ridiculously good. So the performances, I mean, O'Connor, as you said, I was familiar with. He's also, folks might recognize him from Autumn de Wilde's Emma. He has a small part there. He's very good. And that smile he has as Patrick, it's related a little bit, I think, to what you were describing, where he doesn't really care all that much about the outcomes of so many things, and that allows him to smile so easily, even in the most tense moments. His physicality as Patrick. How about when Tashi has goaded them into this somewhat embarrassing story? We'll leave the details unsaid. When she first meets them, they're in the hotel room, and notice how Patrick, he sort of adjusts himself in a certain way as that story is going on. The churro scene, when he slides, even before he bites the churro, how about when Art is coming back with the churros and Patrick, we get an insert shot of this, but Patrick grabs with his foot the stool and slides it a foot closer to his stool so that Art has to sit down that closely. And then just having the cinnamon from the churro all over his face, in his beard, that is like the most Patrick thing in this movie, is that he's not even bothering to wipe that off. So I thought O'Connor was brilliant in that way. I'm going to leave it there, and then we'll get to Zendaya and we'll get to Feist.
Well, I'll help us get there. First of all, Christine Dye, I looked it up, the motel desk clerk, the only person in the movie who is impervious to Patrick's charms. She doesn't care. She just wants to get paid.
She's great.
For her motel room. But you're absolutely right about O'Connor. Came away a fan of his, and it is because of that physicality. It's because of the confidence and how he embodies, very deliberate word choice there, how he embodies this sense of entitlement. We get that he's a rich kid. We get that if he doesn't win at this tennis match, he'll just win at something else. A new opportunity for him to show that he's the best will emerge in the next 5 minutes or the next 5 days or the next 5 years, and he'll just take it as it comes. He doesn't really have the killer instinct that maybe only Zendaya has in the film. And this is where class comes in a little bit. We don't get a whole lot of their backgrounds, but I do think I heard correctly or processed correctly that both Art and Patrick come from wealthier backgrounds, and she's the only one who's really had to work, right?
Yeah, so that sounds right.
She understands and appreciates the game and what it can do for her. She understands the art of tennis in a way that the other two don't really understand and see it more as something that could just be a vocation, because it's kind of all they really know. But also this physicality that you're talking about and the way O'Connor carries it. It's why one of the best scenes in the film is one that takes place in a sauna, where he's using every ounce of that macho-ness to literally get up in Art's face and try to unnerve him, to try to use it as a weapon against him ahead of their match, and use it as a bit of psychological warfare. And what's great, I won't spoil anything except to say that that's where we see a little bit of a different side of Feist's character come out.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So I like O'Connor here a lot. I like Feist a lot. We knew Feist was great in West Side Story. I was fortunate enough. I may have seen Ben Platt's understudy, but I saw Mike Feist play in Dear Evan Hansen and came away thinking, from that on Broadway, that guy is incredible. I can't wait to see what he does next. I knew film would certainly be in the cards. And here it is. We both did rave about him in West Side, and here we are raving about him again. I think it's just such an important line for him to walk, that character, and I'll maybe get into this a little bit more, too. That line where, yes, he is passive. Yes, he is someone who maybe isn't as fun to watch in every scene as Patrick. Maybe he doesn't have that killer instinct, and he needs and is dependent on someone like Zendaya, and so, or her character, and so that makes him seem weaker and less interesting, except Feist doesn't make him less interesting. Feist, he carries all of that. And then let's go ahead and get to Zendaya.
Just real quick on Feist, I'll just add, because it ties to what you're saying, but it's almost the more challenging part in that way, I think.
I agree.
Not just that he's supposed to have, he's charismatic, but in a slightly lower wattage.
Yeah.
But what I like about the performance is that he allows art to change in crucial, critical ways, never losing the internal softness that somewhat defines him. He almost remolds that softness as art ages and becomes more successful. And that sauna scene, you're right, is dynamic, I think, particularly for Feist, where he pushes back, art pushes back against Patrick in a new way. But you still see that, I just going back to the idea of the softness that does ultimately define his character. So that is still there. It's a trickier performance that, mm-hmm. that Feist handles just beautifully.
I agree. And maybe I won't get to Zendaya just yet. I'll help set that up more for you, Josh. We've credited the performers so far for this complexity. We've credited the DP and the editor and the director. I will call out here the writer, Justin Kritzkus. Oh, I think that
incredible screenplay.
Sometimes the charge of a movie, of course, is knowing that you're watching a movie, the characters and the scenarios and the dialogue are all heightened and everything is very calculated and it fits together so neatly. Certainly Challengers exhibits that calculation in its construction and this conceit of the big match that it keeps returning to. A lot of artifice here, right? But we do also see it in these characters, especially in Zendaya's Tashi, who is the puppet master of Art's career and his professional success. And she's pulling the strings early on as well in this trio's relationship. As the object of their desire, she seems to have all the power. At various moments, though, we do see that same type of calculation in Patrick, and we see it in Art as well. So you're watching not just with some suspense, how is this all going to play out? Who's going to win literally on the court? You're also dying to know who's going to win figuratively. Who's going to end up with the power? And are we going to learn, maybe this is at least my sense watching it, are we going to learn that someone has been manipulating things the whole time, maybe even more than we thought, to get a certain result? But where I'm going with this, Josh, is what I think makes Challengers more than just a fun watch and a really satisfying watch is that these are just flawed, frail human beings who have desires and emotions and natural instincts they can't always control. And they have egos the way we all do. And they want to win. And they make bad decisions. And occasionally they hurt people they care about. But it's not because they're sinister or there's some ulterior motive or, you know, grand design by which they're angling to take what they want or take what they deserve. They're just, they're people. That's what I felt watching it. I was constantly waiting. There was this tension where maybe I was waiting for a reveal of some kind. And I love the fact that there really isn't a reveal. The reveal is that these characters are doing the best they can for the most part with the moments they're given in these really intense situations to have to make decisions that are best for them. And they don't always know what to do. They're real people in this film.
I want you to be my coach.
What?
Even if he wins the Open, completes his career Grand Slam, Art's still gonna retire as someone who's just really, really good. That's what you guys will have done together.
But imagine if you could turn Patrick Zweig into a guy who wins a slam. You still have a season. You still have one good season, and I need you to bring it out of me. So, what do you think?
Jesus.
You want my best piece of advice for you? You want me to coach you?
Okay, quit.
And I think that's all in the page, right? It's in the screenplay. Yeah. And this was, you know, astonished to see that this is a newcomer, Justin Kritzkus. I'll have to see if I got that right. But I mean, Adam, this screenplay is brilliant in its overall structure. So just plotting this out where it is this flashback, we start at a certain time and then we'll go back many years, then we'll jump back to this main match. I think that is brilliantly structured, but also Each individual moment sings. There's not a scene that sags. There's not a scene that's unnecessary. And then you add on top of that the dialogue within these scenes. So it's the superstructure. It's the plotting, which I feel is something different. That's on a lower level. And then there's the dialogue within the scenes that have been plotted. I mean, this script is incredible. And, you know, we can circle back to Zendaya here because I haven't looked into how much her role has been as producer, but she is listed as a producer here. So I don't know how involved she was in choosing other cast members, in finding Guadagnino, or when she actually came onto the project, and if the screenplay was something maybe that she saw first. But it's worth noting, she has. This kind of ties into you call her character a puppet master. You know, she's definitely a bit more of the puppet master on this production than just one of the three leads. And so she's doing whatever she's doing in that capacity while giving this absolutely incredible performance. Another person here, I think I first became aware of her, oh my gosh, the Hugh Jackman circus musical, Why Am I Blanking?
The Greatest Showman.
Thank you for helping me out. I remember the trapeze sequences there with her, and obviously she'd done other stuff before, but that was the first time I kind of sat up and was like, whoa, who is this? And this is just, you know, another example of the talent we saw there coming to full fruition in this incredibly complicated performance for all the reasons you were just giving in terms of who she is, who Tashi is as a human.
Yeah, I think this film does seem to apply all of her best traits as an actress. And I've been mixed on Zendaya. It's not as if I've disliked every performance I've seen of hers. I was down on her in Dune. And I think part of that I would place at the feet of Denis Villeneuve and what they do from an overall storytelling standpoint with that character. But one of the things I said during our review, and then it turns out I saw some people talking about this online, not because of my comments, but we all saw it similarly. This frowny face thing in Dune, I just got tired of every time it cut to her. I felt she was being hung out to dry, having to portray some real complex emotions, and it just looked like she was always dismayed. And there's a fair amount of that dismay coming through in her faces here. She has to be very reactionary, right? She's the one watching the tennis match, and we spend a lot of it watching her. But because of its construction, the film itself, and because of how she's constructed this character, it's so much more effective because every one of those reactions is imbued with a different type of tension and different meaning. And her too, that physicality and that confidence, that brashness that she carries, I think is really fascinating. And she's the main character I'm thinking of, Josh, in terms of what I was saying about calculation, where it might have been satisfying on some level to see that she's more of a puppet master than the movie makes her out to be. But I like that she's just as troubled as any character, if not more so than any character in this film. She does stupid things. She isn't always in control. It's a real layered, textured performance that she gives. And I came away a bigger fan of Zendaya, certainly after this film.
Yeah. And the face is so crucial here. I would say it is, certainly there are frowns, but it's also pitiless on occasion and it's merciless on occasion. I think those are even more defining traits of her character, of Tashi here. I also think about her face. Actually, now that I think about it, it's crucial to a crucial scene. A character asks her, how will you look at me if I do something that we assume she would find disappointing? And her response, she's just kind of laying on a bed casually here. Her face has been that kind of that mask. It's a little bit of a mask where it's imposing. And she says, without twitching a muscle, just like this.
Tell me it doesn't matter if I win tomorrow.
No. You tell me if it matters. You're the professional competitor, Art. It can't be about avoiding my judgment. Not a nun. I'm not your mommy.
I'm just asking that you love me no matter what.
What am I, Jesus?
Yeah.
You can beat him.
What if I don't? How are you going to look at me if I still can't beat Patrick Zweig?
just like this.
And what's beautiful is we have no idea what she means.
We're not sure.
We have no, and that is
like. You can
go
with multiple interpretations.
And that is, as Tashi, that's Tashi's biggest weapon, right? Mm-hmm. It's like she knows she holds all the power, and to betray any emotion on her part would be a loss of power. And that was one of her cruelest responses among many that she gives in this movie. Mm-hmm. So a Sam Van Halgren question for you that came to mind. Imagine after seeing Challengers, you're going to do a double feature and you walk out in the theater lobby and the three other screens at this multiplex just have on the marquee Zendaya, Josh O'Connor,
yeah.
Mike Feist. Not fair to any of them to do this,
no.
But it popped into my head is
sure.
Like, I was so thrilled by each individual performance for different reasons that if I had to choose, like, which one am I going into immediately?
They're all extremely talented. I think I've already given you my answer just because I can go back to that stage debut and that experience I had with Mike Feist and Dear Evan Hansen. These performances so far, it's a smaller sample size than Zendaya, but a bigger sample size than Josh O'Connor. All three of them, Josh, after this movie, you're right. I would be tempted to walk into. Feist, for me, is the one who seems to have the most talent. That's the way I'm going to put it. I think he's the most capable of the most diverse number of things on screen. I could be wrong. Zendaya certainly could eclipse him and probably already has, certainly in the work that she's done. But going off potential, I'm going with Feist. What about you?
I think that's fair. Took me a long time to decide. My instinct was Zendaya, but I think I'm landing at O'Connor. Actually, and maybe I'm just falling. Maybe it's just the seduction. Maybe I've just been seduced. But I think it also ties similarly to your experience with Feist, you know, having seen him in a couple of things and just increasingly building on that talent that's there. Would love to see what he's gonna do next. And I did want to say one more thing about you had been describing the outcome of the match and the outcome of the power dynamics and stuff. There was a question that I kept circling around that's related, but a little bit different, is not so much who will win, but who's actually in love here? Like, mm-hmm. like who might genuinely be in love?
Yes.
And is there a chance that there's another person in this dynamic who might be able to return that love? Because that is, for me, the continually shifting question. I'll just say that I think we get a very definitive answer in what is one of the most exciting final 10 seconds in a movie that I've seen in a long time. But it's also an answer as definitive as I feel there might be. Others might debate. And that's absolutely to the movie's credit. That's as closely as I can dance around where this film ends. But I can't recall another movie, Adam, where like mm-hmm. I was that clued into the absolute last second, just like
right.
riveted what, and the sports dynamic plays a part of that, right? Here's the brilliance of choosing this sports backdrop.
Yes.
But honest, as I said before, it really doesn't in the end. They mm-hmm. work so seamlessly in those final seconds.
Yeah. And why I won't argue with you, I don't know where I would put it right now, but why I'm not shocked at all to hear you say that, besides all the other praise that we've given this movie so far, is that this is one of the conundrums of sports movies. I think about Rosie Perez. I think about Rosie Perez in one of my favorites, White Men Can't Jump, right? Where she explains that sometimes when you win, you really lose. And sometimes when you lose, you win. Well, maybe, Rosie, but there are only two real tangible outcomes. One person's going to win or the other person's going to win in a setup like this, right? So there's this age-old kind of sports dilemma, a dearth of potential outcomes, knowing not just that this is a sports movie, a tennis movie, but one that is constructed around this big match. It is leading us inexorably to that finish. And you're thinking the whole time, how are they going to do it? Which route are they going to go? And are they actually going to be able to surprise us
here? Yeah.
And you know it works. You know it's successful when you get an ending like the one we get here, where it truly is exciting. It feels like the perfect bow on the end of the film. It's both a complete surprise and somehow inevitable.
Yeah.
That's the trick.
Yeah, it is.
The ending of this film. I am completely with you there. high praise for Challengers, currently playing in wide release. If you see it and agree or disagree with our takes, you can email us feedback@filmspotting.net. For more Challengers talk, check out our sister podcast, The Next Picture Show. Great pairing going on right now at NPS. Mixed doubles. How about this? Not another sports movie, but another complicated love triangle movie, Challengers and Alfonso Cuarón's Y Tu Mama También. New episodes drop every Tuesday. Find The Next Picture Show wherever you get your podcasts.
For an independently produced show like Film Spotting, we really do depend on listeners to help us out, to spread the word. And there's an easy way you can do that. Just take a minute, give us a rating or a review on Apple Podcasts or on Spotify. We received this review recently from Hoops Maniac. Easily the most intelligent, articulate, upbeat, and entertaining film podcast I've come across. I've been a loyal listener for years, and I always recommend Film Spotting to anyone I know, whether they watch 10 movies a year or are loyal cinephiles like myself. Thank you so much, Hoops. I hope you're enjoying that Wolves Nuggets series. It's a great one. There's another way other listeners can support us beyond those reviews. You can join the Film Spotting family at filmspottingfamily.com. And we want to welcome new family member Kevin Matthews, all the way from Durham, UK.
And Kevin is a new family member who is also a relatively new listener. He found the show via a friend's recommendation. There you go, the power of word of mouth. He doesn't have a favorite Film Spotting segment just yet. He says he'll let us know when we get a review wrong.
Oh.
I'm sure that will come up pretty quickly.
You're going to fit in just great, Kevin.
His Letterboxd four favorites, tough to argue with Jaws, Raiders of the Lost Ark, Sunset Boulevard, and Halloween.
Love the horror nod there.
Yeah, favorite film or filmmaker, Danny Boyle. Jaws is the movie he credits with being a cinephile, like so many of us. And I think 2 weeks in a row, a recommendation for Easy Rider's Raging Bulls, the Peter Biskin book, Kevin's favorite book about movies or movie making.
Well, thank you, Kevin. Welcome to the family, though. Yeah, it won't be official until you tell one of us that we got a movie very, very wrong. Now, in addition to keeping us doing what we're doing, your support as a Film Spotting family member comes with perks. You can listen to the show early and ad-free. You'll also get our weekly newsletter and monthly bonus shows. Our most recent bonus show just came out. That was our British Movies Draft with 1950s Madness winner Ricky Kendall, a fellow UK resident, a proper Brit who joined us for this draft, which was his own idea.
Yeah, it was great. He picked out that Empire list of the top 100 British films ever, though there was a discrepancy there. We learned about 40 minutes into recording that Empire updated that list recently, and some choices that weren't on the first list were on the second one and vice versa. It made for a little bit of confusion, and drafts already confused, Josh, but we made it through that confusion, and we got this response from Jonathan Anderson, who wrote in, subject line, a proper British draft. Mm-hmm. It was a competition until Rookie took Kes and Wicker Man. He's my vote by a mile. Also add Loach to the marathon list, please. I didn't pick Kes as my favorite of 60s madness at the time. Hari Kiri won. It would still be a strong second. But I think about that film at least once a week, if not once a day since. I need more. I think it is fair to at least say this. We are going to put Ken Loach on the Film Spotting marathons list. He needs to be in the mix. Not guaranteeing we'll get to it. Not guaranteeing we'll get to it at least anytime in the real near future. But Ken Loach needs to be in the mix, Josh, and certainly considered for future marathons. Complete archive access is also a perk of being a Film Spotting family member, and you can get all of that at filmspottingfamily.com.
Tom Ryder, the biggest action star on the planet, is missing. You need to bring him back, or Jodie's movie is dead.
Why me?
You're a stuntman. Nobody's gonna notice you. That's your job. No offense.
I mean, some taking.
That's Ryan Gosling in the trailer for The Fall Guy, an action romance from director and former stuntman and stunt coordinator David Leitch. He of Bullet Train and Deadpool 2 and even Fast and Furious Presents Hobbs and Shaw. Gosling is Colt Seavers, a highly regarded stuntman who doubles for Aaron Taylor Johnson's Tom Ryder. Emily Blunt plays Jodie, a director who used to be Colt's girlfriend. Colt is brought onto the set of her directing debut, a sci-fi actioner starring Ryder. Will they rekindle their love? Will Colt solve the mystery of the MIA movie star? Will stuff explode? Will there be stunts that make you feel like you're back in your backyard as a kid, Josh? I'm guessing the answer is yes to the first three. I don't know about the fourth one. Tell us.
Oh, yeah. I mean, this is, what did they used to call movies like this? Something with quadrants, right? Where they hit all these
checks every box. Yeah.
Yeah. Checks all these boxes. And the Fall Guy, you know, definitely tries to do that. And I think is fairly successful in most of those boxes do get checked. The one that gets checked the most, though, and is undeniable, is just the charisma that you've got with Ryan Gosling and you have with Emily Blunt. I mean, the two of them individually, you just want to stare at the screen for 2 hours, and then you put them together. There's some great repartee here. Are these characters as, you know, complicated or nuanced in their envisioning as something like in Challengers? No, they're not. I would say in this case, the screenplay maybe isn't the strength, but this is so fun to see them together. It's fun. It's a movie that's fun, Adam, more in its little asides or its little details. So there's an early scene where Colt comes onto the set of Jodie's movie. She's not that happy to see him there. And so she decides, he's in this scene. She decides to start pinning him down about what went wrong with their relationship via a megaphone, a director's megaphone. And then she has an extra bring him a megaphone so he can respond from where he is on the set. And this is a long back and forth that's a lot funnier to watch, but it's an example of how it's just a tweak to how their argument might have worked in a more boring movie that makes this a ton of fun. Gosling, I'm convinced after this, again, not because it's terrible material, but could make anything work. Because Barbie, you realize how strong that script was. And we talked about that. We talked a lot about what Gosling did with the dialogue he was given. But here, even in the scenes where he's not given much to do, there's just a pause or an arched eyebrow or a head nod or the way he would walk that makes the scene sing. And so in The Fall Guy, you do have something that's it's crowd-pleasing. It's a romantic action comedy. It's ultimately driven by the magnetism of its stars. And it feels kind of like a rare treat compared to a lot of the stuff that we get from Hollywood in this vein. So it was really enjoyable on those fronts. Can I say a few nitpicks and just keep it between us, Adam? Because, yeah, Debbie went.
Sure.
And our high school daughter went with. And I'm getting a lot of pressure at home to go 4 out of 4 stars on this thing.
What?
Yeah. They had such a good time. And I did too. I did too. I mean, they're
have them leave a voicemail.
I'll talk to them about that.
We'll play it.
No, I don't want them to hear this. That script is pretty rough in sections. I mean, and it's especially in light again of what we just talked about with Challengers. It's that overall structure, this complicated plot that isn't really set up all that well and isn't even really followed through with all that well. And then you get to how these two main characters are even drawn out. And yeah, it's not up to the standards we might hope. But then again, you give Blunt that screenplay, you give Gosling that screenplay, and it comes alive. It just comes alive in a way that I don't see how anyone could go to The Fall Guy and not have fun.
Why are you here?
I think there's been a misunderstanding.
Clearly.
Because I was under the impression that you did want me here.
That's a delusional thought. We haven't spoken in a year.
I'm happy for you. This whole director thing looks good on you. Even the gardening hat, somehow.
Everyone wears them. It's like a set thing. Okay?
Yeah, I see it. They're not making you look as good as you are, that's all. And I'm not trying to be flat. I'm just saying the facts. But you look good in everything. You look good in nothing, whatever. No, I don't mean
really?
It like that.
This isn't
look good enough.
This isn't going to work.
You do, but it's not what I'm.
You know, a lot of what you're saying about this film seems to be reminiscent of your praise for a movie we talked about recently, which is another movie you like more than me, The Mummy 99.
Yeah, I think it's, I mean, definitely the tenor is similar in that everything that's happening on screen is just there for you to have fun. I would say this is maybe a little less sharp in its genre interrogation that The Mummy is doing as this sort of Raiders riff, right? Although I do have to say one other thing to its credit is that they put a lot of work into this movie that Jodie is making, this sort of space cowboy romance Metal Storm. I mean, great name.
Great name.
But when you see all of the behind the scenes set, like the costumes of the aliens in this, and how they put a lot of effort into making this look like a real movie that Hollywood would make today, it actually almost kind of looks good. I think I'd go see Metal Storm.
So here's my one question about The Fall Guy for you. My one bit of skepticism. Otherwise, I do want to catch up with the film. And two quick disclaimers. One, I understand that movies are pretend, and I'm capable of suspending disbelief. Also, I know that we are long past the time when Hollywood tried to hold on to the fantasies about our stars on screen and keep them mysterious, Josh, so that we didn't know anything about them and we could project our fantasies onto them. But I've seen so much Gosling and Blunt together over the past 3 months. If you think about Barbenheimer and the awards ceremonies and all the videos of them doing interviews together, all the publicity they've done for this show, Saturday Night Live appearances, they have been together so much. And it's so clear that they're, first of all, they're really very talented and I think have great comedic sensibilities, but it's also so clear to me that they're just buddies, that thinking about watching a film that may or may not hinge at all on their romance, I'm not sure if I'm going to buy it. Now, is that not really relevant here because it's mostly a comedy? Am I overthinking it?
I would say that's how it struck me. But then again, I wasn't going into this necessarily needing to be invested in whatever level of romance there was. So it didn't, you know, it didn't bother me to that degree. I think it's a fair question. I also haven't seen a lot of that sort of extracurricular promotional stuff. So that's probably helpful too. But yeah, if I had to rank, you know, the quadrant elements, romance maybe is not the like the one where they hit the biggest bullseye.
Fall Guy is out now, currently playing in wide release.
In their time, humans were capable of many great things.
Noah!
They could fly like eagles fly. They could speak across oceans. But now it is our time. And it is my kingdom.
Out wide as of this weekend, The Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. This is it the fourth movie in this series, Josh? I'm kidding. I know it's the fourth. I'm only playing half dumb here. Rise came out in 2011. Saw it, liked it. Didn't discuss it on the show, though, for some reason, I don't think. But then we did definitely discuss Dawn of the Planet of the Apes. We both liked that in 2014. And I didn't see War 4 in 2017. I know that you have been, as always, diligently doing your homework, getting prepared, not just for film spotting, I think, but for the day job as well. I don't know if you have any insights you want to share at this point, but next week we will plan on talking a little bit about Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes.
Yeah, just that they all hold up, which I expected. You know, I just haven't revisited these since each of them came out. And for special effects reliant pictures, though they're much more than that, sometimes that's the question, right? Go all the way back to 2011. It's a long time now. And I think they held up not only as riveting human drama, essentially, but also the effects do as well. So, yeah, I'm excited seeing Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes tonight. Can't wait. Hope it keeps up this high level of quality.
Let's see how much this annoys neurotic Josh when it comes to homework. You know what? I think I could probably make time now for War for the Planet of the Apes. I'm not going to do it. I'm going to go in. I'm going to go into Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. I'm going to say, bring it. Bring me up to speed, or allow me to enjoy this film standing on its own without the benefit of having seen the previous film.
I mean, it's a ridiculous position to take, but I guess I could understand it.
In that,
from what I understand, is that this one takes place well into the future. So I know there, obviously, this does not involve Caesar, the main character of the earlier film. So, you know, you've probably got some leeway to make such poor decisions.
We will also probably have some thoughts on Ethan Hawke's Wildcat. That is a movie I have already seen. It's a Flannery O'Connor biopic starring Uma Thurman. I think they somehow just transported her back 25 years or whatever, Josh. It's insane. Of course, it's really her daughter, and Ethan Hawke's daughter, Maya Hawke. And we will also have the final film in our William Wyler marathon, 1953's Roman Holiday. Depending on when you're hearing this, you could watch that movie with us, and not only with us, but on the big screen in 35 millimeter at the Music Box. It is all happening Mother's Day, May 12th, 2 p.m. We will intro the film, and then Michael Phillips from the Tribune, our beloved Michael Phillips, will join us on stage, and we'll tape a short-ish conversation, at least 30 to 40 minutes probably, talking about Roman Holiday. We'll see how much we have to say about it. I haven't watched the film in a good 7 or 8 years, and that's the only time I've ever seen it, Josh. So I'm excited to rewatch Roman Holiday. Definitely excited to see it on the big screen. I know we're going to have a good crowd. Tickets are available. The Music Box holds a lot of people. So if you want to come out, if that sounds like fun, 2 p.m. tickets available at the Music Box website, or you can go to filmspotting.net. There's a promo for it right there on the main page.
Yeah, we'd love to see you there. And as we mentioned before, you know, it is Mother's Day. Make a whole day of it. The neighborhood around the Music Box, there are great places to eat, just to stroll around. So yeah, we would love to see you on the 12th. Also, next week on the show, we'll have results from the current deeply flawed film spotting poll. We're asking you to save a single 60s film that went on not only to spawn long-running franchises, but also have significant influence on future films. So we're thinking of these options: 1962's Dr. No, the first Bond, 1968's Night of the Living Dead, 1968's Planet of the Apes, and then 1960's Psycho. You can only save one with your vote, and the rest, including everything they went on to influence. So not just their official reheats, but anything that drew from these franchises, they're all gone.
Yeah. See, I brought this up last week, Josh, and I'm pretty sure our producer, Sam, who wrote this question, heard me, because I think he edits the show and puts it together. He's doubling down on this whole idea that it's not just what they spawned in terms of direct offspring, but what they went on to influence. So,
of course,
you know,
he is.
Deeply flawed is really applicable to this poll question, but go with whatever criteria you would like. And please do vote now. Maybe even leave a comment. Let us know where you're listening from at filmspotting.net.
Sam is cruel and unusual. What can we say?
He can be. Also coming up soon, we mentioned it last week. We will mention it again. The next quarterly meeting of the Film Spotting Advisory Board. Yeah, it sounds official because it is. They have exclusive voting rights here on the show. They get to weigh in on all sorts of questions we throw at them. That next meeting is Wednesday, May 22nd. So you do have an opportunity to either upgrade your family membership or to join now as a family member. We've got all sorts of good stuff to discuss, including we're looking ahead. Well, we should have started a year ago, but the 20th anniversary of Film Spotting is coming up in 2025. Got a few ideas. We're going to run those by the FAB. Also, Madness 2025 ideas, following up on that. And we do have a new listener suggestion for what our new Film Spotting Madness punishment should be that all three of us like.
Yeah. Speaking of cruel and unusual.
You can join the FAB at any time. It is one of our Film Spotting Family tiers of support. More info at filmspottingfamily.com. I thought it would be fun, Josh, to highlight a little bit of listener feedback we've gotten here recently. You will recall that when we talked about The People's Joker, I mentioned Philip J. Bartel, a listener out in LA. He recommended The People's Joker for the Golden Brick, and he was so glad that we both dug The People's Joker, and he thanked us for the shout out. He wishes he was in Chicago to go to the Music Box, but he had very important all caps in the subject line. And I agree that this is necessary info. He says, "I too microwave Pop-Tarts."
Oh,
13 seconds.
Philip, the question I have for Philip is, have you tried putting them in a toaster? Have you tried? This is what's wrong with society, Adam. What does it take? It's been years, like maybe 30 seconds in the toaster for a Pop-Tart.
Yeah, but
so
maybe
Philip
like
is
maybe
willing
like
to sacrifice.
He is.
Taste
maybe
and enjoyability.
Like me, maybe like me, the toaster's just not sitting out on the counter and you got to get it out.
Oh, let's not even
open that microwave door.
Let's not even get into your kitchen organization.
Let's get to a little bit of William Wyler marathon feedback. Josh Ashenmiller in LA wrote in with an idea for our Weiler Award names. We do need that. We've got a little bit of time because we won't be getting to those awards next week with the Music Box event. We'll have 2 weeks to plan. Still, we need your ideas. Josh says his idea is from Mrs. Miniver. He wants to call them the Napoleons' best cat since Inside Llewyn Davis.
Mm. Not a bad idea, Josh, but I think we all know Adam is not going to allow a name tied to Mrs. Miniver.
No, probably not. And then I'll set this one up too, Josh, because I had a little bit of correspondence here with Sam Thompson in Asheville, North Carolina. Love our listeners so much that they think about us and are so gracious. He wrote in, he said, if I were to hypothetically mail a Blu-ray to Film Spotting in honor of the Weiler Marathon, where should I mail said disc? Hypothetically, of course. Now, you know, I just wrote him back and gave him my address and said, send it to me. Mm-hmm. No, actually, I didn't. I had a feeling where he might be going with this because we had just talked about Mrs. Miniver and Ben-Hur, I think, as well. And I wrote back and I said, well, it depends. Do you intend it for me or for Josh? And Sam wrote back, ha, well, I'm primarily motivated by the fact that you have now taken two Weiler films to task and counting. I'd like to lift the wool from your eyes. It's a film that is unfortunately not streaming and is an often overlooked gem from Weiler's early period. So yeah, it's for you. And I wrote back and said, yeah, I had a feeling. I knew where this was going. And I got the Blu-ray. Sam sent me a movie I'd never even heard of. It's from 1933. Stars John Barrymore. It's called Counselor at Law. This is the IMDb summary. A successful attorney has his Jewish heritage and poverty-stricken background brought home to him when he learns that his wife has been unfaithful. So, 33 movie, pre-code Hollywood movie based on a 1931 Broadway play of the same title, screenplay written by Elmer Rice. Had never heard of it, Josh, but now I possess it.
So, let me get this right. Sam's chiding you for having incorrect takes on Weiler, and you get the disc.
Yeah, I hadn't thought of it that way.
I mean, that's, you know, it's not really that surprising.
Well, he's making me do homework. Mm-hmm. He's saying I need to watch Weiler better. You should appreciate that.
Let's just move on. This is from Dylan Dom. Just wanted to write in and confirm that I heard correctly on this week's show that your next marathon will, in fact, be 90s Kevin Costner films. It seems like you've got the lineup nearly set with Dances with Wolves, Waterworld, and The Postman. You could throw in Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, and The Bodyguard to round it out. I'm already looking forward to the awards show, which I assume will be the Tin Cups.
Hey, good name.
Another, I think, like top five sports movie.
Let's not get crazy. No.
No? Tin Cup?
No, and I'm a Bull Durham and White Men Can't Jump guy, so I like Ron Shelton.
Interesting.
I don't love Tin Cup the way many do, but I've seen that. I've unfortunately seen Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves. The Bodyguard's fine. It's good 90s cheese. It's fun. So I don't know if there's quite enough for a marathon, but certainly those three are big titles that I haven't seen, but I think you've seen all of them,
Josh. I have, and I think among the three, we've got at least 10 hours of viewing there. So it essentially is a marathon if you just do those three
good
films.
Good point. A little bit of golden brick spotting here. Zach Kircher wrote in, said, hi, Adam and Josh, love the show. I recently got back into it after shamefully falling behind on episodes a while back, and I'm reminded that your podcast is such a foundational part of my appreciation for cinema. Thank you for the consistently fun and intelligent conversations about my favorite art form. Thank you, Zach. I also want to shout out a movie that I think deserves your attention for the golden brick. Hundreds of Beavers. Mm-hmm. Not only was it made with a $150,000 budget by a first-time filmmaker named Mike Cheslick, it may just be one of the funniest and most visually creative movies of the decade so far. Words cannot possibly hope to describe how crazy this project is. Just look up a trailer and see if it piques your interest. I also published an 8-minute-long review on my YouTube channel that talks about it. Check it out. It's great fun. Either way, thank you for continuing to be one of the best examples of genuine, thoughtful criticism we have today. So Zach wasn't alone, Josh, and we got more of these emails even than this one from Jordan in New Orleans, who said, I'd like to suggest a movie that may not have the political and emotional heft of The People's Joker, but which feels equally unusual and daring in its style, not to mention being incredibly funny. Yeah, Hundreds of Beavers. It's like Buster Keaton and Looney Tunes channeled through a video game. We were already in. I think now we're especially in. Melissa Taminja, longtime listener, runs a movie theater out in Washington now, the Pickford, I believe is the name of that theater, right? Someone who's been a guest critic here on the show, a voice we always love to feature. She's the first person who made me aware of Hundreds of Beavers, and it has been playing in Iowa City at Film Scene. I haven't had a chance yet to see it with an audience. I would love to. I do have the screening link at home, and I just keep hesitating, Josh, to press play because I know people will chide me for not seeing it with an audience.
Yeah, I know. That's the opportunity I'm hoping for as well, because this has definitely been on my radar. So we'll make it work one way or another and give it that golden brick consideration before the end of the year.
We will. So I'm going to give you honors on our last comment coming up here in a moment, because it really does conclude our summer movie preview that we shared last week as perfectly as possible. But we got this note from Eric, who wrote in, and I'm not going to get into any details, Josh, I promise. I just want to acknowledge before we get any more emails. Eric wrote in and said, you may want to make an exception and watch the new M. Night Shyamalan trailer. It's not even close to what you think. And when I wrote back and said, well, actually, I did watch the trailer before the summer preview, he said, really? That makes your description of the movie even more puzzling. So I somehow missed it entirely, what it's about. I got some of the details right. I just also got some key details wrong, I think. So I didn't pay very close attention to the trailer for the new M. Night Shyamalan movie. What's it called? Trap or Trapped?
I don't know.
It's one word.
This is a mess you've made. You were probably watching the trailer while microwaving a Pop-Tart.
I'm sure I was, in fact. So thank you, Eric, for pointing out my mistake.
Last comment here from Debs in Lafayette, California. Please tell me you're not going to pass up on the opportunity to have an end-of-year retrospective of your Folie à Deux and Folie à Deux à Deux reviews and call it Folie à Deux à Deux? Oh, Debs.
So good.
Oh, that's brilliant.
Yeah. I mean, we had Folie à Deux. We had Folie à Deux Part Deux. Mm-hmm. And now we could, at the end of the year, revisit those and say Folie à Deux à Deux.
Do we just rename the rap party? I mean,
we might.
I think that's what we have to do.
We might, actually. It's a more compelling name.
All right. It's time now for the return of Massacre Theater, the part of the show where we perform a scene and you get a chance to win a film spotting prize. A couple weeks back, we massacred this scene.
Why did you come back here?
Your friend brought me back here. I'm glad he did. Can I buy you a drink?
Oh, I got to change, and I've got paint in my hair. And
oh, it's not your real hair?
No, my hair is like your color, but
okay.
I paint it with this
makeup. Oh, I'd love to see what that looks like. I'll wait for you.
Yeah, okay, sure. Yeah, if you want to wait, I'll come have a drink with you. Sure.
That was Lady Gaga and Bradley Cooper in 2018's A Star is Born, written by Will Fetter's Eric Roth, and Cooper, also directed by Cooper. That massacre was part of a show a couple of weeks ago when we had a 25th anniversary Blind Kyle review of The Mummy, along with 1968's Funny Girl, the fifth film in our William Wyler marathon. So why that scene from A Star is Born? Here's Dylan Dom again, who's out in Blair, Nebraska. The obvious connection is your review of Funny Girl starring Barbara Streisand, who also starred in the quite poor 1976 version of A Star is Born alongside Kris Kristofferson. There's also the connection you mentioned between Bradley Cooper's role as Streisand partner, John Peters in Licorice Pizza, along with your planned revival of the Folie à Deux face-offs coming up, and Lady Gaga's role in the upcoming Joker sequel with the same name, perhaps my most dreaded release of the year.
We're on the same page there, Dylan. Maxwell Fletcher out in New York City says, as soon as Josh mumble-grumbled his way through his scene, my memory twinkled alive with a vague recollection. Mumble-grumbled, that seems accurate, Josh. After listening again, I recognized the scene where Bradley Cooper meets Lady Gaga after her performance at the beginning of A Star is Born. Like that film, Funny Girl tells the story of, well, a star being born and the ultimate disintegration of said star's romantic relationship as she ascends to fame.
Here's Austin, who said that my accent reminded him less of Bradley Cooper and more of Vincent D'Onofrio's humanoid alien bug from Men in Black. You always give it your best, Josh, and we love you for it. Well, thank you, Austin. I try.
Austin was not the only entrant to mention Vincent D'Onofrio's character in Men in Black. So,
oh man, I should have claimed that was intentional then.
Yeah, you must have been channeling that, though inadvertently. Reach into the film spotting hat, Josh, and pick out this week's winner.
Our winner is Clara Gillette. Clara Gillette from La Crosse, Wisconsin.
Congratulations, Clara. Email feedback at filmspotting.net. It will set you up with either a trial membership to the Film Spotting family, a Film Spotting t-shirt, or a Film Spotting tote.
happened to the cannoli line?
Rex, you're supposed to say forget about it, Sanchez. The old man likes his cannoli.
Look, I made a mistake, all right? It didn't make any difference anyway.
Hey, I'm letting it go. But don't say it doesn't matter. Every line matters.
Man, Challengers had a great ending, but I think this show's even going to top it since we're ending with Massacre Theater.
Oh, wow.
What better way to culminate this episode, Josh?
After praising all those performances, we will give folks whatever's about to happen. Sure.
That's right. And maybe I'm a little disappointed. Great scene, great movie, at least one great performance in this movie and in this scene. We'll see what we bring to it. But kind of a boring scene. No funny voices. I don't get to play a British woman or anything. I mean, I could.
I mean, are you putting in requests? Yeah. Yes, you can always play every scene however you want. As a matter of fact,
how it should
whichever
have been.
Whichever part you choose, Adam, I want you to play it as a British woman.
I'm not going to do that. No,
come
I'm
on.
Not going to do that. But I will take the juicier part here. If
okay,
you don't mind.
Yes, please do. I would love it.
Even though the other character in this scene kind of couldn't be blander, and that speaks for the scene itself. You'll hear that with the dialogue. I feel like I was meant to play this character. Nevertheless, I'll go ahead and try the meatier part.
And I'm going to have to be bland. So
yes.
a challenge for me.
Yes, without a doubt. I started off, you're going to give me the action.
And? Action.
I beg your pardon. Aren't you Guy Haines? Oh, sure. I saw you blast Faraday right off the court in South Orange last season. Made the semifinals, didn't you?
Yeah.
I certainly admire people who do things. By the way, my name is Bruce. Bruce Cicero. See, I suppose you think it's corny, but my mother gave it to me, so I have to wear it to please her.
How do you do?
I don't talk much. You go ahead and read.
Thanks.
Now, it must be pretty exciting to be so important.
Tennis player isn't so important.
Oh, but people who do things are important. Now, me, I never seem to do anything. I suppose you're going to Southampton for the doubles?
You are a tennis fan.
And scene.
I thought you weren't going to do a British woman.
How dare you? I was exuding class and refinement, Josh.
Okay.
Did that not come through?
Yeah, no, I got
you
that
were,
too.
You were boring. Well done.
Thank you.
If you know what film we just massacred, email the movie's title and your name and location to feedback@filmspotting.net. The deadline is Monday, May 20th. We'll select the winner randomly from all the correct entries and announce it in a couple of weeks. Josh, that's our show. Off to play a little tennis. We should have a Film Spotting tennis tournament sometime.
I would love it. I can only do doubles these days, but that'll work. We'll figure that out. If you want to connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, and Letterboxd, Adam is at Film Spotting. I'm at Larson on Film. At filmspotting.net, you can vote in the current Film Spotting poll, which is asking you to choose from four 1960s films that went on to spawn franchises. You can save only one. For show t-shirts or other merch, go to filmspotting.net/shop. Film Spotting is listener supported. You can join the Film Spotting family at filmspottingfamily.com. For as little as $5 a month, you can listen to the show early and ad free. You'll also get a weekly newsletter, monthly bonus shows, and access to the entire Film Spotting archive.
In that archive, you can find reviews of other Luca Guadagnino movies like Call Me By Your Name, episode 660, his Suspiria remake, episode 704. I'm a bigger fan of Call Me By Your Name. Also, an interview I did with Bones and All screenwriter David Kajanik. Also, reviews of David Leitch movies like Bullet Train, 884. We had a good top five that time, Josh. Top five Brad Pitt performances. Deadpool 2. Yeah, number 682. We talked a little bit about Deadpool 2, and that show, because it's Film Spotting, features an interview with Paul Schrader talking about First Reform. A little something for everybody, Josh. And Hobbs and Shaw, we reviewed that as well, episode 738. I don't think we've ever done a top five movie stunts, so you won't find that in the Film Spotting archive, but a good one to have for the future, a connection there to the Fall Guy. And Sam wondered if we've done top five menage a trois movies, which sounds like a different film podcast. We have done top five love triangles, however, but it was before your time, long time ago.
Okay.
Episode 247. So we certainly could revisit that topic.
And is there a top five? Because this would have had to be before my time too. A top five sports movies. It seems like one that had to
have been done. It seems crazy to think that we wouldn't have done that, but I'm not sure that we have, Josh.
Oh, someday.
Yeah. That's filmspottingfamily.com for more. In limited release, Harmony Korine's Aggro Drift is out. The Last Stop in Yuma County as well, starring Jim Cummings. He's a figure we've featured here on the show before. The writer, director, and star of Thunder Road, The Wolf of Snow Hollow. Brian Tallarico, our friend at RogerEbert.com, calls it a blast. In wide release, you can see Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes, which we're planning to talk about on next week's show, along with that final film in our William Wyler marathon. Make it a day. Come to Roman Holiday in 35mm. See it with us and Michael Phillips and your moms, hopefully. Music Box, Sunday, May 12th, 2 p.m.
Film Spotting is produced by Golden Joe Dassault and Sam Van Halgren. Without Sam and Golden Joe, this show wouldn't go. Our production assistant is Veronica Phillips. Special thanks to everyone at WBEZ Chicago. More information is available at WBEZ.org. For Film Spotting, I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
Film Spotting is listener supported. Join the Film Spotting family at filmspottingfamily.com and get access to ad-free episodes, monthly bonus shows, our weekly newsletter, and for the first time, all in one place, the entire Film Spotting archive going back to 2005. That's at filmspottingfamily.com.